Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Keith O'Brien about his new book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. We'll also hear from Randy Fertel about his new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. O'Brien is the author of Outside Shot, Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness, as well as the bestseller Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, and Paradise Falls, The True Story of an Environmental Catastrophe. Today, we're talking about his new book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. He's speaking to us today from his home in New Hampshire. Keith O'Brien, welcome back to The Reading Life.
So good to be with you again, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. Now, we're all somewhat familiar with the broad outlines of the Pete Rose story. So what was it that drew you back into it for such a lengthy and considered treatment?
I think there are three reasons. First, it feels like now is a time for reckoning, in part because Pete Rose is about to turn 83 years old.
Yeah.
And everybody else who was in the room with him, on the field with him, in the clubhouse with him, placing bets with him, they're also in their 70s or 80s. So it just felt like an important time to try to get this story on the record, perhaps one last time. Two, you know, the world has completely changed.
Yes.
In the 35 years that Pete has been banished, in particular in the last six, sports gambling is now legal in most states, and in many of those places, we can place bets on our phones. So, you know, what better time to revisit the story of one of our most notorious gamblers than now? And then thirdly, and I think most importantly for me, I don't see this as a baseball story. And I think that is different than some of the other pieces that have been written about him. I really see this as a human story.
Sure.
And frankly, very early in the process, you know, began to see this as a Greek tragedy that just happened to play out on an American baseball field. And so that was the way I wanted to come at it, sort of with intimate access to a man who, whether you like him or not, is one of our most fascinating athletes of the 20th century.
Now, at first, you had his cooperation, and you did 27 hours of interviews in person, and then he shut down, but you persevered anyway. So talk a little bit about that process. I mean, to think you're going forward, you know, with full access, and then to have to switch approaches in a way, and what was that like to kind of lose him?
Really early in my reporting, I got access to him, and he was all in. At times, he was texting me to set up a time to talk. And, you know, I did do many hours of interviews, both on the phone and in person. As we progressed, I wanted to cover all the highlights of his career, but I also wanted to talk about the gambling and about, frankly, the unraveling of his life in the 1980s. I will say that Pete shared things with me and talked about things with me that he's never talked about before. But I do think it's also hard for Pete to do that. And I don't know what happened. I don't know why he stopped calling me back. We didn't have a falling out, but he just did. And, of course, it did change the landscape for me. In the several weeks where Pete was cooperating, he was helping to open doors for me at times. And then, you know, once the access was gone, you know, the cooperation and the door opening was gone, too. But the thing of it is, with anyone as big as Pete, And he was one of our most iconic figures in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. He's touched hundreds of lives in personal ways. There's just so many people to interview here. And so, you know, once he stopped talking to me, I just continued to move down the list to everyone who potentially might have something important to share about Pete Rose.
So much of his fall had to do with his own shortcomings, his sense of entitlement, purity, stubbornness, you know, the sense that he would never get caught. You talk a lot about how everybody who knows Pete Rose has strong feelings. There aren't any, take him or leave him kind of, you know, reactions. So what was it like to interview his family and his friends? Because they've been in touch.
Yeah, they have. I mean, I've interviewed people for this book who've never spoken before about Pete. And, you know, Susan, you and I used to work together at the Times-Picayune. We've both been privileged enough to interview thousands of people over the years. And sometimes those interviews are emotional. In this case, you know, no one has died, right? No real human tragedy of that level has happened. And yet I was stunned again and again how many people would actually break down and cry when remembering times with Pete Rose. And some of these people who were emotional have been wronged by him and were upset by that wrong and still carry that pain. And other people would become emotional when just remembering the glory of a certain moment. I will say one thing that helped me understand that was having the access to Pete Rose. And I got to say, this is a man who, again, has made lots of terrible personal decisions in his life. And yet, like certain famous people, like the most popular politicians or our most popular actors, he has a charisma about him that is palpable and tangible when you sit across the table from him at a diner or a restaurant or at a ball game. And to be in his presence helped me understand a little bit about what it must have been like to be in Pete Rose's inner circle in the 1970s and 80s when he was truly at the peak of his fame.
Now, sports heroes arouse such passion in us. You know, it's a combination of their passion for their sport and then the passion we feel for them, looking at them, having that. What are the challenges of writing about that passion and keeping it alive for an entire book?
You're right about that. And I think that people, and especially fans, like to project their own feelings upon the heroes they root for. It happened, you know, with Drew Brees in New Orleans. It happened with Tom Brady in New England. It certainly happened with Pete Rose in Cincinnati and, frankly, across the Midwest in the 1970s and 80s. One of the goals of writing this book was to rekindle that feeling in readers. You know, again, in the last 35 years, you know, Pete's sort of become a caricature of himself, especially as he lied for many years about what actually happened. And because of that, I think everyone, including baseball fans, has forgotten why we ever loved him in the first place. And so for me, again, from a narrative perspective, in order to care about somebody's fall, and Pete Rose does fall, we have to remember why we cared about their rise in the first place. As I looked at the story and as I, you know, did my interviews and reporting and research, I tried to identify those moments, those peak moments where Pete transcended sports and, you know, came through our television screens and radio broadcasts and grabbed us around the collars and made us care. And so in every moment when that happened, whether it was the 1970 All-Star Game or the 1975 World Series or, you know, his hit streak in 1978 and on, that's a point in the book where I tried to pause and linger longer in the moment so that, you know, readers could hopefully almost hear the crowd cheering, you know?
And yet, you know, one of the things that stayed with me the most were those descriptions of him swinging that bat over and over again. You know, the relentless quality of his devotion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, multiple people told me, and it was written even at the time in the 1970s, you know, Pete would sometimes hit in the batting cage until his hands bled.
Yeah.
And he would show up at spring training, you know, in February and March every year. And his goal was just to get those calluses back on his hands. And that is a real thing about Pete Rose. You know, this notion that he would work harder or work longer or work more than others. You know, I recall an interview I did with Larry Boa, who was a star player for the Philadelphia Phillies in the 1970s and 80s. And, you know, Pete Rose joins the Phillies in 1979. It's the first time Pete has left the Reds. He signs a major free agent deal. He's going to Philadelphia. And Philadelphia has never won anything. But they have been on the cusp of making it to the World Series for a number of years now. And Pete is hopefully, in ownership's eyes, this missing piece. And Larry Boa recalled, you know, early in that season, they've already returned from spring training. They're playing. The season has begun. They're in Philadelphia. And Boa will leave the ballpark at night, he said, and could hear the sound of a bat hitting a ball in the indoor batting cage down the tunnel from the Phillies locker room. And every time he ducked his head in as he left, it was Pete Rose swinging. And again, this was a guy who had just signed a 4-year, $3.2 million contract, which doesn't sound like much now, but it was a heck of a lot of money back then. It was one of the biggest contracts in baseball. And there he is, you know, swinging in the indoor batting cage in old Veterans Stadium long after everyone else is going home.
I have to say, Keith, I'm not going to spoil it, but this book has one of the best endings ever.
Oh, my gosh.
So people, don't look ahead. Don't look ahead. Just save it.
That is so nice of you to say, Susan. I really appreciate that.
Well, it was pure pleasure. We've been talking with Keith O'Brien, whose new book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. You can meet Keith Monday, April 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Keith, thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Randy Fertel is the author of that New Orleans classic, The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, a memoir about his colorful parents, as well as A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. Randy's passion for improv led him to found the memorable improv conferences, which took place in 2018 and 2019, Improvisation, New Orleans Gifts to the World. Now he's back with a new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. Randy Fertel, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
They're classic New Orleans characters.
I still get compliments, and it really warms my heart. It's really wonderful.
It's not forgotten. Now,
thank
listen,
you.
In your new book, you're looking more deeply at improv. You know, you're just unable to let it go, I guess. And so now you're looking at its dark side. So describe that dark side for us.
Well, let's not start with the dark side. Let's start by talking about how this has stayed with me for 50 years. This was, you know, something I stumbled on in a graduate seminar, and I wondered, what is it about this that makes it seem like so many of the other books that I love? And I finally figured out it was this gesture of spontaneity, this gesture, you've never seen anything like this before. And so I started pursuing that, and once you go looking for that gesture, it's everywhere. My unpremeditated verse, says Milton. And then I figured out that if you went looking for the archetype, the mythic kind of quality to that voice, it was the trickster. It was the guy who liked to stir the pot and make trouble. And so that I wrote The Taste for Chaos, which you were very generous toward in our last wonderful interview. But that was a more academic book, and that was trying to make sense of how important that gesture was in Western literature. But this time, that I published that book 3 months before Trump came down the golden escalator. And when I heard that first speech, I thought, oh, my God, I knew there was a dark side, but I didn't know how dark it could get. And this is too important to leave to the academics. I need to write a book that's meant for a general audience and that doesn't deal with, you know, the big boys in the Western canon, but talks about popular culture, thing, everyday things.
When I think of improv, for example, I think of lightness and I think of humor and I think of speed, you know, the speed of response. And I wonder if doing all this research and thinking about improv has changed your way of relating to the world.
Well, I wish I was a better improviser. As a professor of English, I was totally committed to discussion method, which is an improvisation.
I
really do not believe in lectures. The definition of a lecture, the 60s definition of a lecture, a process whereby the ideas of the professor get from his yellowed notes into the fresh notebooks of the students without passing through the brains of either. Mm-hmm. So I'm totally committed to improv, but you know, when I'm faced with giving a talk in front of an audience, I go to a text. I just don't have that charisma that's so important to improvise. I'm taking classes and I'm trying to get better. But the book itself is an improvisation in this sense, that having thrown out the Western canon, decided I'm not going to talk about the dead white men. I'm just going to follow my nose. I'm going to start with jazz and see where it goes. And so I just went wherever they sent me. One text, one discourse would lead to another. And so, you know, jazz led to Fred Astaire's tap dancing. Mm-hmm. And Fred Astaire's tap dancing led to hip hop. And it was great fun. It was my COVID project.
Uh-huh.
You know, I started on that first super spreader event. And I never entered a library. It was all done on the internet or by buying books off the internet. And I was working long days. I had so much fun. So in that sense, I guess, because, you know, they were my models, so that gave me permission to follow where they took me. I didn't have to be all academic. I mean, one of the things that happened here is that once you throw out the academic kind of discourse, you realize, you know, I'm not really sure I know what improv is. What is it all about? Why does it have this power? And so I went into neuroscience. I went into bioevolution. There's all kinds of new insights from those two fields. And they basically explain that though we have one brain, we have two minds. We have two ways of attending to the world. And one is hot cognition, the other is cold cognition. One is instinctual, intuitive, embodied emotion. The lower brain, the limbic brain. And the other is the frontal cortex, the cold cognition, rationality, logic, step by step, how things work. You want to know how to build a fire? Well, first you do this. Well, how about the first time someone came up with making a fire? How did that happen? Well, that was somehow probably hot cognition at work. So I felt like I was really getting to the nub of what improv's all about.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Randy Fertel, whose new book is Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump. You talk about how exciting it was for you to find that there was a name for what you were trying to do, improvisation studies. So what do you think are the areas left for us to explore there?
What you're talking about is that there is this field now called critical improvisation studies. And I think improv touches everything. It's mm-hmm. the source of all the innovation that we stumble on. But for me, the the issue is the critical piece. We need to ask the question, well, what is the link amongst these different kinds of discourses which we attribute this word improv to? People in that critical improvisation studies world talk about this or that discourse, maybe linking two or three, but they don't just ask the big critical question, what links all these different fields that where improv matters? And I think that the hot and cold cognition starts to get you to the heart of the matter. And it figures, you know, in social media, that social media is one big improvisation. It's built on by cold cognition on that creates algorithms and, of course, a platform. But then it lets go. It says, algorithm, all we need you to do is to increase engagement. So the algorithm uses machine learning, and it goes looking for ways to engage people. And it quickly sees that what engages people is fear and anger, those most hot cognitive emotions that we have little rational control over. Suddenly, you know, social media is this huge process, which Trump used to the max, to create all this political tribalism, and or to not create it, but to increase
it, use it.
And to use it. And it's something that we really need to address. We really somehow need to get past that. And it won't be easy. People are really digging in. And you know, what it goes to finally is, you know, the democratic process is all about persuasion. It's about discourse. It's about trying to persuade one another up to the point where, well, let's compromise. But tribalism is based on the premise that, well, my tribe is right and their tribe is wrong and they can't be reached, so let's not even try to reach out to them and persuade them. And, you know, my book comes out of a tradition of rhetoric, that rhetoric is the art of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And my central trope is that this gesture of spontaneity is the rhetoric of spontaneity, the persuasive power of spontaneity. So it's finally about trying to renew our engagement with persuasiveness, our belief in persuasiveness as the process that is at the heart of democracy, persuasiveness and then compromise.
And we'll see a lot of that over the coming months this year. So good timing,
well,
good timing. We've been talking with Randy Fertel, author of Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. You can meet him when he appears in conversation with Lola Sarek Eli, Thursday, April 4th at 5:30 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. Randy, thank you so much. I'm glad this book saved your life.
Thank you, Susan. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care, you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Percival Everett discusses and signs his new novel, James, Saturday, March 30th at 4 at Baldwin & Company. His book, Erasure, was the basis for the film American Fiction. This is a ticketed event. Get tickets at percival.eventbrite.com. Farah Roshan signs her latest book, Fate Be Changed, A Twisted Tale, and appears in conversation with Marty Dumas, Monday, April 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Guild of Wizardry and Whimsy, a fantasy book club, meets Tuesday, April 2nd at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Lauren Grodstein signs We Must Not Think of Ourselves and appears in conversation with Alyssa Speranza, author of The Italian Prisoner, Wednesday, April 3rd at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Randy Fertel signs Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump, and appears in conversation with Lola Sarek Eli, Thursday, April 4th at 5:30 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. Jeffrey Morgan presents Art Show on Words, Literary Portraits, Friday, April 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Books Along the Tesh takes place April 5th through 7th in New Iberia. The featured Great Southern writer this year is Natalie Bazile, author of Queen Sugar, and other special events will feature a Zoom interview with James Lee Burke and the dedication of the statue honoring him in New Iberia. Check out BooksAlongTheTeshLiteraryFestival.com for tickets and complete schedule. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library Big Book Sale is coming up April 12th through 13th at the Pontchartrain Center in Kenner. The New Orleans Poetry Festival's cubes are out. You can get your complete schedule at NOLAPoetry.com and start planning. The festival runs April 18th through 21st at various locations, headquartered at the New Orleans Healing Center, and expands statewide with the New Orleans Poetry Festival Roadshow beginning April 16th. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.